Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Kevin Cook. He is the author of the brand new book, 10 Innings at Wrigley, the wildest baseball game ever with baseball on the brink. The book is available now wherever your fine books are sold. Kevin, this takes us back. You take us out of the ballgame on a day at Wrigley Field in 1979, May of 79, the Phillies and the Cubs. Your subtitle about baseball on the brink, what was on the brink in 1979 at this time?
Well, what was on the brink was the ball game as we know it today. 79 was really a moment right before the steroids era. Fans and readers who go and take a look at the players of those days, there's some great clips on YouTube, will be surprised at how remarkably skinny they were. You've got, Dave Kingman is the most feared slugger in the game at that time. He's 6'6 and 210. He's 50 pounds lighter than Anthony Rizzo or Chris Bryant. The game is also going to change enormously in terms of the money that cable TV is going to pour into the game. 1979 is the year that the Cubs are first on WGN, the superstation, and that's what's going to turn them into a national brand, along with the Braves, who have their own superstation. In 79, there were 50,000. There were 800,000 cable TV households in America. 10 years later, they're going to be 53 million. That's going to change the game a lot. And also, metrics are just getting started. Across town from Wrigley Field in the White Sox clubhouse, Tony La Russa is getting mocked for looking at computer printouts. That's going to change everything. So the evolution of the game is really just on the brink of becoming what is familiar to us today, and that has great implications for the game itself. And I found it fascinating to take a look at a game just before all that took place.
The other thing that I noticed is the money involved. The Phillies had a payroll just under $5 million. Cubs had about half of that. Was that about where the Cubs were? Was that about average for the rest of the teams in the league? Because the Phillies had Pete Rose at the time, who was the highest paid in the game.
Right. The Phillies had a high payroll. They were a glittering bunch. Tug McGraw had said he was always very thankful to Rose for making the big money and changing that part of their existence. Rose, of course, was making an unheard of $800,000 a year, along with Dave Parker of the Pirates. He was the highest paid player of all. McGraw told the press, he said he kept thinking that when he got in the big money, he was going to get himself a really nice truck. And then when he saw how big the money got in the next decade, he said, the heck with the truck, I'm going to get a plane. The Phillies were very well paid. The Cubs were much more down in the middle of the pack. And, of course, the Cubs are still lovable losers. It wasn't 2016 yet. They had not won. There was a Cubs T-shirt that you could buy that said Chicago Cubs World Champions 1908. That was their last time. It was really a matchup of two franchises that had been snake-bitten for the longest time. As well paid as the Phillies were, they had not won a World Series. They're going to have to wait two more years to win their first. So there was one cynical Cubs fan who looked at these two teams about to play and said it's almost a shame that somebody has to win.
Well, going into the game, the Phillies were in first place. The Cubs were not, obviously, but it was the rubber game of the series. And so the first inning takes off, and realistically that first inning could have been a book in and of itself, right?
That's true. Neither starting pitcher made it out of the first inning, and you kind of had an inkling of that when you look at the flags, as all the players do when they reach the ballpark. The flags are blowing out to left. The winds are gusting. They're at 18 miles an hour going up to 30 miles an hour. So neither starting pitcher is going to make it out of the first inning. The Phillies get seven runs. In their half, there were even a few fans who just rolled their eyes and left early. The park was only half full as the game began. So there's no expectation that this is going to be anything much more than another dreadful Cubs loss until the Cubs come back and get six and knock Randy Lurch out of the game. So it's 7-6 at the end of the first inning. This is when, after the game, Larry Boa said it was the craziest ball game ever, and then the second inning started.
Well, you know, the way you have the book set up, you've got a different chapter for each inning, and then at the beginning you've got history of both teams, and at the end you have sort of a where are they now several pages about a lot of these cast of characters who were in this game. And Aaron Boone's father played in the game, right? The current manager of the Yankees?
Sure did. Bob Boone was the Phillies catcher, and it's always great to talk to the catchers because they remember pretty much every play or almost every pitch. And can really give you a perspective on what's going on all over the field.
The history part for both teams really interested me, and particularly the section about the Cubs. You talk about a fellow named Charlie Wegman, who I had heard the name, but I really hadn't read much about him. Can you kind of explain who he was and what he did to get this whole ball rolling in Chicago?
Well, it's interesting that I think at least people who saw the movie with Michael Keaton know of Ray Kroc. He's the man behind McDonald's, and he's thought of as the first fast food tycoon. But the first American fast food tycoon really was Charlie Wegman, who had a chain of luncheonettes in Chicago. The working people wanted to have a nice, inexpensive lunch. He would give you a sandwich and a glass of milk for a very reasonable price, run you through there very quickly. That was the fast food empire that built Wrigley Field, which began as Wegman Park. He bought a Federal League team because wealthy Charlie, who was called Lucky Charlie around Chicago, couldn't get a National League or American League franchise, so he built a team for the Federal League Chicago Whales, and it was a palace. It was really the best ballpark one of the best new ballparks. Comiskey Park was relatively new, built by the same architect across town, and really was an engineering feat. This is men with horse-drawn carriages and wheelbarrows and shovels, picks and axes and saws. There was some machinery involved too, but I was astounded to find out that they built a ballpark in 7 weeks. I don't think municipalities could get something like that done today.
Well, the ballpark's been under reconstruction now for about the last 7 years.
That's true, and there was a time, you know, in the time that I spent many, many, many afternoons at Wrigley Field, and a little bit after 1979, but it was like it was in 79. You'd walk under nets because the mortar was falling. You didn't want big chunks of rocks and cement hitting the fans' heads. So it really was like a construction site at the time. It was kind of in what was called a sketchy neighborhood, not the wonderful Wrigleyville that we know today. It wasn't even called Wrigleyville. It was called Lakeview in those days.
What I thought it was interesting, Al Capone was a Cubs fan.
He certainly was, and he had good seats. And that was the unusual sight that you would see in Al Capone's day, that Capone would sit in his marvelous seats right down by the field, and the ball players would come over and ask for his autograph. In fact, there was one who was seen photographed in the papers all over the country with Capone, and the new commissioner, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, saw that picture and didn't appreciate that, didn't think that that looked very good for baseball. So, he banned having your picture taken. Don't go over to Al Capone anymore, he said. And then he got a telegram saying, if you don't want me to hang out with Al Capone, then I'm not going to tell him. You tell him.
Well, you know, so much of the history in this book, all nonfiction books contain these little nuggets, and you talk about this Federal League. You mentioned it earlier. There was a scene in the book that you described where the Boston Terrapins didn't want to disband when the rest of the Federal League disbanded. The case went to the Supreme Court. Oliver Wendell Holmes had a great quote when the case was tossed out about baseball not being a business. Can you explain that and just how silly that sounds today?
Yes, well, that was the Supreme Court rules that baseball is exempt from antitrust laws because it is a game and not a business, which would have been news to the businessmen who were running the game. Not particularly news to the players because they were poorly paid and and I knew where they were at that time. That ruling, thanks to the Terrapins taking it all the way to the Supreme Court and losing, is the source of the reserve clause that is going to keep players in a sort of bondage to the owners until much later, until Marvin Miller, the tremendous leader of the Players Union, comes along in the 70s and finally beats the owners in court and wins players the right to have free agency. That's another one of those things that I often think that everything in baseball is connected. You mentioned Bob Boone and his son Aaron, now managing the Yankees. He's a second-generation player himself, Bob was. Everything in baseball seems to be connected, and that's one incident that really the Federal League was the reason that that the reserve clause came about, and that changes the entire future of the game.
You mentioned Dave Kingman earlier, and in fact his picture's on the cover of the book. Mount Prospect, Illinois kid. What was his relationship like with the media?
Not so hot. He had a sort of integrity, for a really nasty sort of integrity. He didn't feel that it was his job to be a PR man for the team or for the game. He thought his job was to hit. So he was always grudging at best with the players. He was also tremendously sexist. He was one of the leaders of the players who said no woman should ever be allowed into the locker room. This is a men-only place. Famously, he sent a live rat to Susan Fornoff, who was a writer from the Sacramento Bee, who came in, and all she was trying to do was to do her job. It was interesting to find out that rat survived the whole escapade, and she gave it to a little boy who promised to take care of it, and so the little boy got the rat as his pet with only one stipulation. She has to make sure that he named it Kong, and he did, after Dave Kingman. One interesting thing about Kingman, though, is that he was mocked universally for striking out all the time. He was a strikeout machine because he struck out 130 to 150 times a year. Of course, that wouldn't even put you anywhere near the leaders these days. The leaders strike out 200 times. The all-or-nothing approach, the three true outcomes approach, a home run and a strikeout, that was what Kingman did, as opposed to Bill Buckner, the other star hitter for the Cubs. And I think the subsequent evolution of the game has vindicated Kingman's approach at the plate. But it didn't make him any more popular with the press.
Toward the end of the book, you're wrapping things up as far as where these guys' lives gone. There's tragedy, there's success, there's Hall of Fame for some. The Pete Rose story you cover in there, and I hadn't thought about this for a lot of years, but Pete Rose had this fortuitous thing that after he agreed to the gambling, to the ban, lifetime ban from baseball, Bart Giamatti and him had some type of agreement that, sort of an informal agreement, that Rose could apply for reinstatement. What happened with that?
Well, that's true. That, of course, is Pete's side of the case. We don't know what Giamatti would say about that informal agreement, because Giamatti had a heart attack and died before anyone else could know about it. Pete has always felt snake-bitten because of that moment. Of course, Pete continued to deny that he had bet on baseball until the evidence mounted to the point that it was undeniable. At that point, he not only wrote a book about it, but began signing autographs saying, "I'm sorry, I bet on baseball." This is who Pete Rose is. Pete Rose was a hero of mine when I was a little kid, and I still think that he was, beyond any doubt, a Hall of Famer on the field. His malfeasances, his sins, his now no longer denied betting on the game came when he was a manager. I don't think anybody ever considered him a Hall of Fame manager. So I think there's a case to be made that he certainly belongs in the Hall of Fame as a player. It was very interesting to me that I felt like I should ask him, due to the fact that we're talking about 1979, and here come steroids, another blotch on the game's history. And I asked him whether he thought steroids were worse or betting on baseball was worse. And he told me that he thought steroids were worse than the way he bet on gambling, because he always bet on his team only to win. That's a distinction of great significance to Pete, but not really to the rules, because the rules have always said don't bet on baseball at all.
All right. Well, this book, you've got it set out. I'm not going to spoil how the game ended. Everybody's got to read the book, or I guess they can just flip through it to figure out how it ended. But nonetheless, there's so much baseball history here, and it goes against the old adage for sports writers that you never need to write about the first half of the game. This one, you wrote about the entire game, and it was interesting the entire way through. The book is 10 Innings at Wrigley, the wildest baseball game ever with baseball on the brink, by Kevin Cook. Kevin, just a fantastic book here for any baseball fan or history buff. Thanks for putting it out, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, and thank you for reading it. It's a pleasure to have this talk this morning.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.